You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. My guest today is Bob Drogon. Bob Drogon is a national security reporter with the Los Angeles Times, a newspaper he's been with since 1983. And I believe, Bob, you've been covering national security affairs since 1998. And I invited Bob on today because he has just published a book in October of this year called Curveball, Spies, Lies, and the Con Man Who Caused a War. Curveball was the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency codename for an Iraqi defector in Germany who claimed, among other things, that Saddam Hussein was operating a fleet of mobile biological weapons labs. This worked its way into a variety of reports, including the State of the Union report, and people attribute a variety of things to that information. Bob Drogon has acted as an investigative reporter here and tried to get to the bottom of Curveball, who he was, what he did, why he did it, and what the effects were. So that's what we're talking with him about today. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Bob, who was Curveball?
Curveball was an Iraqi chemical engineer, raised in northern Baghdad, went to the university there. He defected to Germany in 1999, and he went as a sought political asylum, went through a refugee camp there at a place called Zirndorf.
He was a straight refugee. When you say a defector, he was not an intelligence officer.
That's correct.
He went as a refugee.
That's right. Sorry. He was treated as a defector in this situation. He was a refugee. He sought political asylum in 1999. And at some point after, shortly, within weeks really, after he had landed in this refugee camp, which I went and visited, and which is a fairly miserable place. It looks like a prison, frankly. He was being undergoing a routine interview by the German intelligence service, the Federal Intelligence Service there, known as the BND. And during that first interview, he began to talk about not uranium. In fact, it was mobile biological weapons laboratories. He was talking about biological weapons. And he began to spin an extraordinary story to the German intelligence authorities, which was that he had helped design and build a fleet of vehicles that could carry biological weapons production facilities on trucks and trains. And they pulled him out of the BND, pulled him out of the refugee camp, set him up as an informant, and began to pass his information on to the Americans and other intelligence services.
Okay, we have only a limited amount of time, so I'm going to jump forward a bit and then perhaps go back and ask you a few questions. How did, and he became known as Curveball, mm-hmm. that was his BND code name, I take it.
It was actually an American-issued code name. There was a group in Munich at a place called Munich House. It was a Defense Human Service team, and they're the ones that first, as best we can tell, first issued him the code name Curveball. So, his real name is Rafiq Alwan.
I know you've written an entire book on this, but in a word, in a few words, How did Curveball's information, which right now we have no way of knowing whether it was true or not, that is, if we go back in time to that moment when the BND first heard it, how did that information make its way into the higher levels of American intelligence and eventually into the State of the Union speech and also become a consideration in the decision to go to war?
The German authorities have very close relations, obviously, with the United States intelligence services. And in particular, the BND works very closely with the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. And the DIA has a wing there called the Defense Human Service. Defense Human had a team in Munich. They were getting this information, these reports from the BND. They were passing them, putting them, translating them, putting them into U.S. intelligence channels. They were moving through the system. They didn't have very much impact at first, but after the September 11, 2001 attacks, these reports were pulled out of the safe and suddenly were given much higher priority. And they wound up not only in this President's State of the Union speech, but Colin Powell, when he went to the United Nations, really used them as the highlight of his speech to the Security Council.
My understanding is that the German service, the BND, had reason to doubt the information rather early on, that they had reason to think perhaps he was what's called a fabricator, somebody who makes up information either for money or glory or to get better living conditions if he's a refugee. Is that your understanding, that the Germans early on had the sense that his story...
The Germans issued a series of warnings to the U.S., particularly to the CIA, to the station chief in Berlin and others, warning that basically Curveball, that they had not confirmed his story, they could not vet his background, and they didn't know whether he was a fabricator or not, and that was their concern. Moreover, they felt he'd had a nervous breakdown, they thought he might be crazy, and they were concerned about the veracity. They couldn't prove it one way or the other, was basically what they were telling the Americans.
Was that told to the Americans early on?
The investigations found various warnings in the files, I think as early as 2000. His information was coming in 2000 and 2001. The first CIA officer who went and actually saw him was in May of 2000, and he came back and wrote a report saying he thought the guy might be a drunk, which of course doesn't mean he's a liar, but he was basically concerned enough about it that he put it on paper. And he was the only person, the only American to meet Curveball, to our knowledge, until a year after the war. Part of the problem in this case was when the CIA in particular was really highlighting this report, this man's information, they weren't disclosing to policymakers that they had never met him, they had never confirmed their information, and frankly didn't even know his name before the war.
Given that the Germans had concerns about him, as you said, that he had a nervous breakdown, appeared to have had one, appeared that he might be crazy even, that's the word you used, and that the one CIA officer who saw him thought he might be drunk, obviously concerns about his stability, let's put it that way. How did someone assessed in that fashion, how did his information gain such credence as it went up the line?
You know, I considered a conspiracy of carelessness, that there was wishful thinking going on, that at a number of places along the way that I was able to highlight in the book, where you had people in the intelligence community saying, huh, this looks bad, but somebody must know more than I do about this. Or, well, his information seems plausible, and I really don't know about these other issues. That is, the descriptions that were coming in seemed plausible, what he seemed to know about the trucks. What wasn't clear, because the Americans never got to interview him, was how much of that information really was coming out of the German the German intelligence authority. That is, they were filling in the gaps the way they described it to me. They were helping him. They were giving him books on engineering and whatnot. And he was using that. And it turned out he was going to the internet and reading old United Nations weapons inspections reports about Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program. And he was feeding back this information that made him sound considerably more knowledgeable than he was. It also turned out he was giving them this information back, and they were passing it along. And by the time it got to here, to Washington, there was such a fear after 9/11 of having missed the story, of having missed the threat, and being criticized after 9/11 for having failed to connect the dots. That in this case, I believe what they did is they made up the dots, you know, or they ignored the problems.
What in reflection, what do you consider his curveball's motivation might have been to continue to sort of feed
into? Oh, it's very clear. His motivation was he wanted asylum. That's very clear. Everyone who has, both the German authorities and the Americans who finally interviewed him, and I unfortunately was not able to do so, but I've talked to the people who did, was he just trying to get, you know, what a lot of people want. He wanted a ticket to the West. He wanted a Mercedes. He wanted a job. He wanted to get his family out. He wanted to get out, you know, from the tyranny of Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
Of course, as with many defectors who have information, for a while they're sort of center of attention, they're living better, they're treated well, away from this sort of almost prison-like situation that you described earlier. What might have been, what do you think would have was the German motivation to sort of, as you put it, fill in the blanks?
There were a couple of issues happening. One was years, really decades, of distrust and antagonism, in particular between the BND authorities and the CIA. All during the Cold War, the CIA had treated the BND really as a stepson, you know, and rather they dismissed them. They treated them, at least as far as the Germans were concerned, with something close to contempt. And there was reason for that because the BND had been penetrated repeatedly and at the most senior levels by East German and Soviet bloc intelligence services. So there was this sense that the BND really wasn't in the big leagues and they didn't trust it. And some of the people in the BND who I spoke to, it made it clear that this issue became, on one hand, pride of service. They had this guy, the Americans didn't have him. He was claiming to have this extraordinary access. The Americans really had no one in Iraq at that point. And there was this sense, why do we have to give them up to the Americans? We're perfectly capable. In addition, there was a degree of the man who was the head of the German, who had the cabinet rank for intelligence, Ernst Erlau, had been the former chief of police in Hamburg. And he had personally taken great umbrage when after 9/11 U.S. authorities blamed the so-called Hamburg cell for the attack. And he had felt not unreasonably that, wait a second, these guys lived in America for a long time and they operated very openly there. Why are you blaming us for this? And so he felt sort of that the Germans had been fingered or somehow unfairly blamed for 9/11. So you had a lot of sort of personal issues as well as these professional ones. And frankly, as you know, there's not a tradition of one intelligence service necessarily just handing over a source to another one. I mean, the CIA doesn't even let, you know, the Pentagon, the DIA, interview their informants. So, or their agents in this case. So the Germans basically said, no way, when the Americans asked for access. And they didn't think it was a problem because they, from what they said to me, they couldn't imagine that America would go to war on the basis of these secondhand reports of a guy who they warned whose information had never been confirmed.
What role do you think the information provided by Curveball played in the decision to go to war?
Well, it's not so much what I think. The Rob Silberman Commission, which was appointed by the president to investigate the intelligence debacle in Iraq, as well as the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, both concluded that Curveball's information was the chief, if not only, source of intelligence on Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program. So it's not just whether I think that's important. What also came clear in that is that the analysts at the CIA who were analyzing Saddam's chemical weapons ramped up their conclusions, the confidence level of their conclusions about Saddam's chemical weapons program when they saw the reports coming out of the BW crew. That is, they thought, well, it's much more difficult to build a covert biological weapons program than it is to do chemical weapons. And Saddam had this enormous, robust chemical weapons program back in the 1980s, before the first Gulf War. If we're so sure he's got this BW program now, this redundant, robust, program now, then he must also have the chemical. So they went from what they believed was ambiguous evidence, where they said they were drifting as to whether it was real or not, to saying, quote, with high confidence he has these chemical weapons and he has produced, you know, 100 to 500 metric tons within the last year. When you go back and you deconstruct some of this, it's really, to me, quite shocking. In the National Intelligence Estimate, which really lays some of this out, that came out in October of 2002, there are some calculations that are in there that Saddam must have biological weapons greater in quantity, for example, than he had before the Persian Gulf War. And the way they reached that conclusion was they took Curveball's information that he had worked on one truck, and they estimated what that truck might produce. And then they multiplied that by the six other trucks he said he had heard about. And then they multiplied that by saying, well, what if these trucks ran 6 months without, you know, without stop, 24/7? And of course, anyone who knows anything about Iraq, nothing in Iraq runs 6 months without stop. So there was sort of this wild, what somebody described to me as a wag, I guess is the term of art, a wild-ass guess that was used. And it wound up being the highlight, really, in the National Intelligence Estimate, which is supposed to be the gold standard of American intelligence products. But what wasn't clearly recognized at the time is that NIE, that estimate, became the template for the speech that Colin Powell gave to the United Nations. I mean, that was the information he was using to convince the world, and certainly Americans as well, that the threat from Saddam was so significant that America was justified in and the international community was justified in going to war. To answer your question, I think it played a significant, if not dominant, role. Curveball is not the only reason. Obviously, the Bush administration and the Blair administration in London decided to go to war. But if you go back and you look at their statements, it's very clear it played a very significant role.
Was there some sort of arm wrestling between the CIA and the administration over this information, this intelligence, what Curveball provided, as before Powell gave his presentation, before George Bush's State of the Union speech? You do hear in some of the accounts that have been published that there were attempts by a CIA to keep the administration from overly using the curveball information. Over-reliance on the curveball.
Not really. I mean, in fact, the opposite is what happened here. The reason I think this case is so disturbing is, as a reporter, I hear a great deal about these conspiracies, you know, these a team of people, you know, in the Pentagon, you know, whispering in Vice President Cheney's ear or funneling stuff through the back door of the vice president's office. What's so disturbing here is that the Curveball information really was briefed to the president, briefed to the vice president, briefed to senior members of Congress. It was delivered to them on a silver platter and was the official product. What there was a battle within the CIA between members of the clandestine service, and in particular the head of the European division and the group chief for Germany and a few of their aides, and members of what was known as WINPEC, the Weapons Intelligence Nonproliferation Center, which is the analyst side of the shop. And the clandestine service officers were basically looking at this and saying, wait a second, we haven't met this guy. We haven't vetted his background. We don't know anything about him. We need more than that. And they got a specific warning that this man might be a fabricator. That is, the German station chief here in Washington, their resident agent, met with a member of the CIA and warned him there's a real problem with this case. What happened at CIA was that people from WINPEC, from the analyst side of the shop, said, that's not our problem. We believe this information. It looks good. It smells good. It's very plausible. We're going to go with it. And the senior leadership in what I believe was really a extraordinary failure on their part sided with the analysts and just, you know, backed down on this thing. To be fair, I think there were a number of people who probably didn't realize at the time how critical this information was. That is, they didn't know that so much was hanging on the words of this one man. And so I had the head of the clandestine service told me, then at the time, told me, you know, it was too late to do anything anyway. You know, we could have tap danced nude up and down Pennsylvania Avenue and wasn't going to stop the administration going to war. But he also said we didn't know how important this guy was. So the battle was within the CIA. It was not about between the CIA and the administration. There's no question that George Tenet, who was then the director of Central Intelligence, John McLaughlin, who was his number two deputy, his number one deputy, thoroughly backed this information.
So by the time the administration or those dealing with the Iraq situation got it, from their point of view, it was coming from, quote, intelligence.
Absolutely.
This is what intelligence. So there was no, at least as far as the curveball information, there was no distortion or misuse of it at the administration level. By the administration.
Well, exactly. I mean, what you had is Colin Powell told me that before he gave his speech at the United Nations, he went out to the CIA and he spent 4 days out there. And initially, what had happened, he had been given a speech prepared by the office of the vice president. Scooter Libby was then the deputy, who had given him this lengthy speech, 48 pages or something. Secretary Powell and John McLaughlin and others looked at this material and decided it was really what they described as garbage. I mean, it was just a series of, it was not only the intelligence they had, but it was rumors and it was allegations and it was unsubstantiated. And when they went through it, it was just sort of a laundry list of charges, a lot of which they couldn't back up. And Powell got very upset and said he wasn't going to do that. And that's when Mr. Tenet said, well, let's look at the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate. This is the best we've got. It's already been vetted. And Secretary Powell said, I still want to see the underlying information. And it was as they were going through that process over a four-day period when Powell repeatedly and his aides repeatedly asked the others at the table, you know, what's your best stuff and you know, how good is this curveball information? And they were repeatedly told it is absolutely ironclad. It is incontrovertible. We have no doubts about it. So when he went to the United Nations and said, as he did, first biological weapons and made it the absolute highlight of his speech, and I think we all remember the pictures he showed of these trucks, except that they weren't pictures. They were what he called cartoons, that CIA artists based in the basement of the building out at Langley had drawn based on analysts' descriptions, based on reports that had gone through a series of changes, but that ultimately came from interrogations that the Germans had done, but not transcripts, just their reports of it, that had been done from Arabic to German to English and had gone through this transmogrification. So by the end, it appeared absolutely ironclad, but in fact, in some cases, really didn't reflect what Curveball had said. And one, I'll just give you one very clear example of that, which is when Secretary Powell spoke, and in the NIE and in other places, there was this great fear that these trucks could produce what they called weaponized biological agents. That is, that the trucks carried these sophisticated drying and grinding machines to turn these the soupy kind of biological material into an aerosol, like an asthma inhaler. Well, it turned out when they went back and looked at it, there'd only been one German report to suggest that, and although in fact the Germans had passed on more than 100 reports from Curveball. Only one of these reports had suggested that, and when they went back and looked at it, turns out that had just been a mistranslation along the way, that in fact Curveball never really said that. So it's sort of when you peel this back, what I found is it gets worse and worse. It doesn't get better.
Did the clandestine service have a seat at that table when Colin Powell was trying to scrub the information, try to determine
yes.
a basis for it?
Yes.
And sounds from what you're saying, they did not challenge it in that session.
There was a Defense Intelligence Agency officer there who knew that a separate source, that is a source who was supposedly being used to corroborate Curveball, that officer knew that that source had already been declared a fabricator, was listed in the U.S. intelligence channels as a fabricator, and he said nothing about it either.
Well, Bob, you tell a fascinating story. I think those of you who are interested in hearing the details can get a hold of Bob's book, Curveball, Spies, Lies, and the Con Man Who Caused a War. Bob Drogon, put out by Random House, came out in October of this year. Bob, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum, that's one word, .org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.